And one of the things that I will say about companies that I've worked with in this industry is there is so much love, there is so much support, there is so much really intent to do right by those individuals and to figure out how to do that within the context of the law and the context of risk management. And that has been so cathartic and so beautiful for me to witness.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Many see Bitcoin as incompatible with modern financial compliance programs. The sheer idea of sharing your personal information with a bank or financial service provider is a cardinal sin for some hardcore privacy proponents in the Bitcoin community. Yet, we need Bitcoin financial services to be compliant with the existing banking system to allow people to easily buy it and sell it. Building a compliant service on top of Bitcoin does not make Bitcoin any less revolutionary of an asset. A great example of this is the Bitcoin ETFs. While it has undeniably opened access for a new type of investor to buy Bitcoin, it has not detracted away from Bitcoin's features or capabilities in any way whatsoever. It is a net benefit to the Bitcoin ecosystem. In the most general sense, compliance is about abiding by a general set of rules that will ensure a basic level of service. This ensures that whoever is overseeing the activity can later enforce the rules if they catch any wrongdoing. If you want to have the protection of the host government, you need to comply with their requirements. An interesting example of the complex relationship between Bitcoin and compliance is how some champions of decentralization run to the authorities to report a hack or exploit seeking their help, or how many people impacted by crypto scams claiming to be decentralized seek the protection of the US courts when they incurred losses. In order for Bitcoin and digital assets to keep eating the system, we're going to have to continue building compliant financial services that bridge the gap between the new world and the legacy system. Ledin and Coinbase are two good examples of this. No one knows compliance better than my friend and compliance expert, Amber Scott. She is the founder of Outlier Solutions, Inc. and a certified anti-money laundering specialist with a wealth of expertise in ethical and legal compliance. I was incredibly inspired by her story and blown away by her insights. I know you'll love this chat just as much as I did. Amber, so great to see you again. Long overdue catch up. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's always good to see you. And I love the work that you're doing on the show. They've been fascinating episodes to listen to, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And I'm really happy you're a part of this because your story, as people will find out today, is incredible. And it's one more story of amazing Bitcoiners and people doing work in Canada and how Canada punches above its weight in this industry, which is overlooked many times, but we'll shine the light on this. So can you tell us a little bit about what was life growing up for young Amber?
Difficult. I grew up very poor in Northern Ontario. And this is a thing that I started talking about primarily because of someone that I worked with when I was a banker, who is absolutely phenomenal, who at one point said to me, Amber, you're different people at different times, and you're going to hit a ceiling as a leader unless you figure out what your authentic voice is and how to speak authentically. I really had to sit down with that and realize that I had a lot of shame and I had a lot of things that I never wanted to discuss and I never wanted to talk about. And I think the first time I talked about the intersection of poverty and growing up poor and growing up with a parent that was abusive and would literally steal my money and how that affected my interactions with Bitcoin and how I thought about Bitcoin and Bitcoin self-custody as being incredibly powerful. I can't stress enough, I am okay. I am very much at peace with the past is the past and things happened. But at various points in time for me growing up, I had a biological parent. If we got like birthday money, I started working outside the home babysitting. So any money that I would earn, if it was in cash, would just get confiscated when there was whatever. So there was never this real possession of money. The first time that I opened a bank account, that biological parent went to the bank, drained the money. Eventually, I was in foster care, and so I opened my own bank account at a different bank, and they found out about it and found a way to go there and drain the money. my first sort of big girl job was at a restaurant, and I would deposit my restaurant check into the bank and then it was just gone. So I learned to go to the bank that the restaurant banked with and just get cash, which led to this biological parent that I'm no longer living with at this point in time, going to the restaurant and trying to get the restaurant to give them my check so that they could go cash it. It was crazy. And at every turn, I'm a child. Like, to preface this, at this point in time, I am 14 years old. I am 15 years old. I don't have the social skills to deal with this. I feel like I'm the customer and my bank is supposed to be protecting me. But that's not my experience. The thing that I learned from that is really that, as crazy as all of that sounds, no matter what institutions promise you, there's a possibility that institutions can fail. And that the more vulnerable you are, the more important that it is that you have financial self-defense. And I think that comes from really understanding how things work. So I learned to ask questions about who can access this account, who cannot. If I need someone not to be able to access my accounts, what does that do? And this has carried on into my adult life. So I've had no contact with that biological parent for years. But still, I deal with legal agreements and make sure that when I'm doing anything like a will or a power of attorney, there's very clear instruction that this person, if I were to be deceased tomorrow, couldn't access any of my accounts because I assume they haven't changed. I think some people have gone through that experience with a government where we have this idea that the government's supposed to protect us, they're supposed to have our best interests at heart. And I think that's a really similar experience to when we're growing up. We think that a parent is supposed to love us and protect us and have our best interests at heart. And sometimes that's not the case. And that's where it's important that we build these self-sovereign skills.
It's such a direct story that highlights the importance of self-custody and having this concept that Bitcoin allows you to be the custodian of your own assets without having to ask for permission from anybody. And what I always say about Bitcoin that I love about it is that it gives you the options. You are the master of your kingdom, and you can choose to go to an institution and have it custodied by someone else or access services, but you don't have to. I think that's a very powerful story. And there's going to be a lot of people that are going to listen to this and become inspired and really understand why this is so important.
I actually have seen a number of situations where there has been someone who is a youth that has a parent that is abusive. And these are, I run a compliance consultancy, so these are questions that I'll deal with from my clients in the crypto industry, where the question becomes, we're dealing with someone who's underage. They've given us circumstances where there's a transaction that is not going to be done. There's no parental consent. There's no identification of the parent or guardian. And where do we go with this? And how do we do this? And how do we facilitate the transactions and manage the risk related to that individual when that individual has disclosed, for instance, that the parent is an addict and they're the ones paying rent, when they've disclosed that there is financial abuse in the home and they don't in any way want to reveal that they have access to these funds, but they're using them to do the basics that you would expect the parent to do, buy groceries or pay rent. They're going and selling a little bit of Bitcoin every now and again because then they suddenly find the money for groceries and they're helping to support their family and their siblings where the parents have failed to do that. And one of the things that I will say about companies that I've worked with in this industry is there is so much love, there is so much support, there is so much really intent to do right by those individuals and to figure out how to do that within the context of the law and the context of risk management. And that has been so cathartic and so beautiful for me to witness.
That is a really great point you bring up, Amber, and it's so great to hear it from a compliance professional. There's this wrong idea that Bitcoin or crypto facilitate bad things and they're used by bad people to do bad things. What I think gets missed often is how many people are actually trying to do good, legitimately using this technology to get to people that you otherwise couldn't have before. And we can do that. There's ways of doing that. And that gets sometimes overshadowed by the people that just have other types of interests and they want to see other headlines. And so the good gets lost many times with the bad. And for you to highlight how many companies are trying to do good with a very concrete example on how Bitcoin is helping potentially a young person from keeping their financial independence and allowing them to help their family better than the powers that be or the parents could themselves.
I cannot stress this enough. If you're a compliance geek watching this and you're leery, I get it. When I first came into Bitcoin, all I knew at that point, and it was like 2013, and I knew about eGold and I knew about Liberty Reserve and that there had been money laundering charges. And I was just primed to think that it was very sketchy. So left to my own devices, I wouldn't have wanted anything to do with it. But Peter Taylor was doing payment processing at the time, and he called me up and he said, we're doing payment processing for this Bitcoin exchange. It's turning into a lot of our volume. I'd like some help updating our risk assessment. And he is brilliant. And I just adore him as a human being. And I do have his permission to talk about that. And the opportunity to work with him overpowered the idea that I was like, oh, do I really want to do anything in this Bitcoin world? I was like, yeah, I want to work on it. So I asked him to pay a retainer in Bitcoin, which was like ludicrous, but it was my company. I could do that. And with most things, I've been a banker, I've worked in securities, I've worked in insurance, I'm using these other financial facilities all the time, but I hadn't played with Bitcoin, so I didn't know how it worked. And he was like, yeah, we can do that, but you're going to have to set up a wallet. I'm going to send you some articles. I cannot help you do that because I cannot have access to your private keys. You need to understand how this works. I'm going to send you some things. And I was like, okay. And he sent me articles. And then I didn't sleep Thursday night. I missed a meeting Friday. I was just going down the rabbit hole, as they say. Lots of times getting really angry at the structure of it and thinking about all of the uses and the possible malfeasance and the way that things could go wrong and just being absolutely frustrated at the idea of a $21 million cap and how weird and arbitrary is that and what is that actually doing and like how I have an MBA and this makes no sense to me. Monday, Peter called me and he was like, do you feel like you're ready to secure a wallet? And I was like, no, dude, but I've set one up but I have the key and like I want to play with it. I want to understand it. Everybody always asks if I kept that Bitcoin. And I feel like that would have been the wrong decision because I had to like play with it. I had to sell some at an exchange. I had to buy something. I bought a tablet that promptly got left on a plane, which is probably one of the most expensive tablets in history in retrospect. But no, I had to understand how it worked. And we've as a company kept taking payment in Bitcoin since then.
From what I know, I believe that your interest around compliance came before your interest around Bitcoin. So I'm curious, can you explain a little bit about how that journey was to get you interested in compliance? What was your thinking at the time and what did you think that could lead to when you were older?
So, I mean, I tripped and fell into compliance completely by accident when I finished my undergrad. I did an undergraduate degree in psychology. I started out thinking I'd want to be a clinician. I did some co-ops and learned that there are wonderful people that are full of empathy that cannot take that work home with them. I am not one of them. I was really a lot more interested in math at that point. And so I wanted to take a year or two off before doing grad school and figure out what I wanted to do. And I saw this post from Manulife and I thought, that looks really interesting. And I had wonderful 20-year-old bravado and thought like, I have none of the hard skills and all of the soft skills and I can just learn the rest. And someone hired me. I learned an awful lot, but I started there in August of 2001 and in September 11th happened. And everything about the conversation in anti-money laundering compliance and counterterrorism compliance changed completely and really rapidly over the next few years. And so it was interesting and it stayed interesting. And I learned absolutely so much about money and financial systems and the way that different things worked doing in-house compliance. I think some of those early roles, so a big part of that early role was that I did dealer compliance. So people that are out giving financial advice and selling products and this and that. And one of the first really big type of a client getting mad at me conversations that I had as a compliance person was that we would screen people. And Manulife at that time had as its goal to be the most professional insurance company in the world. And I think they succeeded. I have nothing but great things to say about Manulife. And they had rules about who can be an advisor, right? And this is going to seem like the lowest bar, but part of that was that you can't be out giving folks financial advice if you're bankrupt. There were verifications of these things. So there would be credit checks. And I had someone just absolutely tear a strip off me, call me little girl, cuss me out, all different, you name it, just ridiculous, dehumanizing, like, I'm going to call your boss, get you fired, you don't know what you're talking about. Because we had pulled a credit check and they were in fact bankrupt and they hadn't disclosed it and they were out giving financial advice and that I was the phone call from compliance that was like, hey, so
wow.
You're suspended and this is the case. This would have happened in like 2001. So it was pre-social media. But I feel like if I was talking to that same guy today, he'd be a guy on his website with a ton of bling, with a sports car, doing the flashy lifestyle crap. So I think there's something about those early experiences in compliance that were really good in terms of inoculating me against being impressed by flashiness.
Amber makes a really important observation here. It's incredibly tempting to fall for the flashy promises some companies throw at you. However, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Now, falling for these tricks doesn't mean you're gullible. It's only natural to think that the companies you're dealing with are being honest. Usually, there are rules that prevent them from promoting lies. But unfortunately, just like in any industry, there are bad apples who deceive and can sometimes defraud. We've seen this play out time and again in a variety of industries across time. Most recently for crypto, just take a look at what happened with FTX. He shook the right hands of all the regulators and elected politicians of all parties and literally lied and defrauded to all of its partners, investors, employees, and most importantly, its clients. One of the most challenging aspects to witness about the FTX fallout was that the fraud went on for as long as it did. But we have to understand that there can be real consequences for being a whistleblower and trying to speak the truth in a time of excess. Amber can shed some light on that aspect.
This is a pain point too, though, because companies that are like that and folks that are like that tend to be very litigious. They tend to be quick with the threats. They tend to be quick to send letters or try to have lawsuits about slander, defamation, blah, blah, blah. And to really prevent people from speaking out. And I think there's a kind of a care and caution that we as companies have to look at. We have to choose our battles in terms of, do you want there to be some big, ridiculous lawsuit? And that's really unfortunate. I think there are definitely both individuals and companies that have really abused the legal system in that way. And that's a bummer. And we have to exercise caution because we're taking care of our own businesses and our own reputations. And the other point that I think is difficult is that fraud takes seconds to commit, right? The fraud is almost instantaneous. Serious financial crime investigations take years. Securities investigations take years. Money laundering investigations take years. These things are not instantaneous. The burden of proof is very high. Sometimes it feels frustrating where we see these scams being perpetrated over a long period of time and no one doing anything about it. That doesn't mean that nothing is happening in the background.
You were a compliance expert when you found Bitcoin. So what was your impression of Bitcoin as a compliance professional when you first read about it? And how do you think that's changed today?
I think the things that I found attractive about it were that the immense potential for good. And part of that for me when I was learning about it was that idea that it's easily transportable. And these are all good for compliance professionals, all things where you're like, risk, where it's, so you can have a series of letters and numbers. You can have it on a piece of paper. You can have it in your brain. You can cross a border with it and it's useful at the other side of the border. And as a compliance person, that's terrifying. Friends, family who escaped from the Khmer Rouge arrived here with coins in the baby's diaper. Because the hiding the coins in the baby poo was the only way that guards at the refugee camps wouldn't rob them. And so they managed to literally have two gold coins when they got to Canada of the entirety of their wealth that they left behind. And you hear all of these crazy stories again and again. So I think the immense potential for good as a human was really clear to me. I struggled as a compliance person with the inverse of that, which is the immense potential for bad things. Like here you have all of the things that from a money laundering perspective are risky. You have this rapid movement. You have it happening digitally. You have it happening across borders. You have it happening in a way that's essentially unstoppable as long as you have a miner that's willing to confirm that block. And so there's a lot there. And then also this immutable public ledger. And I think the first time that I started looking at a block explorer, I just burst out giggling And my first thought, and I know a lot of Bitcoiners are going to hate this, my first thought is like, do the cops know about this? This is the best thing ever. The RCMP must just be applauding this every day of the week. It's taken a little bit of time in terms of that knowledge and that technical know-how to make its way into various law enforcement agencies. But I think we're really seeing that maturity now, which is where we're seeing crimes committed in 2016 actually coming to court at present day, is because that chain of evidence is just there and very clear.
So is it fair to say, to your point, like, for anyone that has concerns on Bitcoin's allowing you or facilitating you to do bad things, once you understand the immutability of the ledger, a lot of that goes away, I would think, because it's much harder to hide inside the Bitcoin network than it is to hide inside a fiat world or inside a cash settled world. Like, it's in Bitcoin, there will be crumbs and trails of your transactions. There is no way for you to do this reliably without leaving a trail of what you did. So it's actually a horrible tool to do bad things with.
It is, but I think, like, sometimes Bitcoiners don't do ourselves any favors either. And there's a lot of things that can be used for bad things. I have these scissors. I could theoretically get stabby with these. But the scissors company is not advertising these as the best scissors for stabbing. And I see a lot of times where there's something that'll happen where something will be blocked for sanctions reasons or for some other legal reason, or someone will get themselves into trouble where they've legitimately done something that's offside with the law. And you see just this string of posters that are like, you should use Bitcoin. And basically, here's how you can use this for malfeasance. And I think that's a little bit, I wish we wouldn't. And then there's certain types of scams. So when we talk about ransomware and when we talk about payments related to electronic crime that have really propagated in a way that I think is facilitated by the rapid transactions. And so that's another, it's another piece that's difficult, right? We as institutions have to figure out how to better deal with that. I think that we've come a long way in doing that, but that's still part of the struggle and part of the balance.
You start in compliance, you find Bitcoin through this client, he makes you your payment and your retainer. From that moment, when did you decide that you wanted to focus squarely in Bitcoin or crypto? And how did you get your first crypto or Bitcoin clients after that experience?
I think a lot of that early on ended up being word of mouth. I was introduced to an exchange. The exchange invited me to speak with them on a panel about risk at Bitcoin Expo. I started going to meetups at Decentral in Toronto and just kind of meeting folks, and always with the goal, like, I never went anywhere to try to sell something. I just want to understand what people are doing, how people are using this, how is this ecosystem working? And that very organically led to conversations and led to working with different folks in the space. That genuine curiosity and just showing up in those days was really helpful. And then talking about it, although I took some flack for talking about it. So both from people in the Bitcoin community at the time that were like, whoa, are you a cop? Are you investigating us? Why are you here? What are you doing? Type of thing, which, fair enough. And also flack from the other side of things. In early talks that I did that related to crypto, because I had talked about it, because I had written about it, I would get contacted by compliance conferences, banking conferences, securities conferences that were like, can you have a background in traditional finance and you present well, can you talk about what's happening in this space? And those reactions were sometimes really angry too from folks. I had a really fun dressing down from a guy in the securities sector after my first securities talk where he was like, I'm never going to offer any of this to my clients. And you have to understand there's not enough market cap. And he went off and I was like, it's okay. You don't have to be excited about it. I'm excited about it. It might not be for you. And that's all right. And he was like, why aren't you offended? I've just told you off and you're laughing at me, lady. I still feel that way. I think Satoshi said it best where he was just like, I don't have time to explain it to you. It's not going to resonate with everybody. And that's okay. And I'm not here to sell anyone on the idea that this is really cool, interesting tech that has a ton of potential to make people's lives better. I'm excited about that. And I'm going to keep working with folks that are interested in building in that space and doing things with that But I don't need everybody in the universe to be excited about it. There's lots of things that I'm not excited about.
You know what's funny? It's fascinating you said that, you mentioned that, because I find that there's this genuine peace around Bitcoin for people that believe in it, not because of something they've read, but because something they've experienced. Okay. And I've experienced hyperinflation, authoritarianism, and no property rights, and people taking stuff that was mine and inflating things and failing on promises. The way I describe this is that for me, Bitcoin is a when, not an if, because I know people are going to experience things like I experienced. Someone in Canada right now is going through what you went through when you were a kid. And the second those people find Bitcoin, there's not enough books in the world that are going to make you sell that Bitcoin. When you get shaken at the core the way people have, there is no explanation needed for Bitcoin. And there's this sense of peace that comes upon you. When somebody starts laughing about the price or laughing about the project or questioning your beliefs, and you really just don't care. Like, it's an immense peace. That's how I would describe it.
This is another place where I think we as Bitcoiners, like, you see this conversation around people where they're like, oh, have you tried to orange pill this person? And there's a degree of, if you're trying to sell me something, and I think this is true for most people, that if someone is trying to sell me on something, I am infinitely less interested. And Adam Grant has a really amazing chapter in his book, Think Again, where he talks about something that's almost like the Socratic method of questioning in terms of being more apt to change someone's opinion than trying to sell them something. And so just asking questions. And it doesn't work if you're asking questions just to be waiting to jump in to say something. It's, you have to be genuinely interested in the person's response. You have to be willing to go through a dialogue where you really understand where that person is coming from. And this is something where people are skeptical of Bitcoin. I'm always more prone to take that approach if they want to have a conversation. Sure, let's have lunch and let's chat about it. You can ask me all the questions you want. I'd like to ask you some questions. And talking about those things and talking about what's available in certain situations and even talking about more typical North American situations. I had a contractor in New York and I had sent her money by wire somewhere between my bank and her bank. It didn't arrive. So I had the confirmation. My bank is saying sent it. We can't find it. And this is essentially money that needed to be used for her to pay her rent. And what eventually happened is that this had gone on where it's okay, the money is somewhere in transit. Okay, fine. We have the money in our company's bank account. You're going to agree by email that if it gets to you, you'll just pay me back. That you need to pay your rent when? Tomorrow. I sent her Bitcoin to her address at her exchange, and they were able to get money. So the Bitcoin received, transaction confirmed. They ACH'd money to her account in the US. It was there. She paid her rent. And that really traditional finance situation, like the most traditional of traditional finance, when you start talking about the time that it takes to make these cross-border payments, and what you actually need, and what happens when something goes wrong, and what's the traceability of that, and what's the visibility of that, and what's the provenance of that. It's almost miraculous the way that Bitcoin operates.
Yeah, and I want to highlight this anecdote because we had one of the early sessions at Ledin when we first launched Ledin. And one of the first things that we advertised for Canadian clients was that we would disperse loans same day, no matter what Canadian bank you were. And that was something you couldn't do in Canada. Even if you had a bank account at TD, you couldn't send money to someone at Scotia and have it arrive on the same day. And one of the things that we got asked a lot was, how do you guys allow or enable same day disbursements for Canadians? That was like mind bending when we announced it. We basically had accounts in all major banks, all funded, such that if a client showed up and they needed to fund the TD, the account was funded from the TD account, and then we would rebalance. And at times, Adam and I would have to basically take money from one bank, walk it across the street to the other bank, and basically deposit it. Obviously, those days are far gone. We no longer operate this way, but it was, to your point, a very fiat, Canadian fiat problem that we solved, not through, even through Bitcoin, but it was a Bitcoin service that kind of gave you a teaser of what it was like if the fiat system operated Bitcoin did. It's fascinating, to your point, how problems that are so small can be so relatable, seemingly so simple, like not being able to get same day settlement on from Canada to the US or from one Canadian bank to another. Whereas in Bitcoin, you would never even have to think about this as an issue.
You don't have to think about it at all. And it matters to people. It matters to people so much when they have to do something like buy groceries or pay their rent.
You've been in compliance since pre-9/11. You saw how 9/11 shifted the world of compliance. Now you've seen the rise of Bitcoin and crypto assets and just decentralized and permissionless assets, decentralized and permissionless money. And transparently, I think the world has been in a bit of a lull in terms of conflict geopolitically between sort of 9/11 and now. There's been a few flare-ups here and there. But right now, we're squarely in a point in time where there seems to be a lot happening. There's little fires lighting up everywhere in terms of geopolitical conflict. And there seems to be a few attempts, misguided attempts, at trying to make crypto seem as the, maybe not the enabler, but something that is being used to facilitate some of this behavior, which we both know is wrong, or probably not accurate, is the best way to describe it. But how do you think permissionless and decentralized assets have impacted compliance to date? And how do you think permissionless and decentralized money has impacted compliance to date? And what do you think it's going to do to the future of it?
I think you hit on a really interesting issue early on, which is how do we classify it? And I remember thinking about that. Like sometimes it acts like a security, sometimes it acts like a payment rail, but sometimes it's acting like something else that doesn't really fit into either one of those buckets. And I think that's been hard. And that's been something that regulators have struggled with. And I don't envy them that question. And then we're rapidly moving towards having systems that are actually truly decentralized. And I'll be the first one to say that I think most things that describe themselves as being a DAO, so a decentralized autonomous organization, or a DEX, a decentralized exchange right now, are not at all decentralized. And that's true in the vast majority of cases. But we're starting to see some cases where that is true. And then I think that's a really big question in terms of where those fit. I think Bitcoin was a really big question in terms of where it fit. Particularly because early on, there was this sense that there isn't a set, there's not a company, there's not a central control in the same way. There's not a foundation, there's not any entity that you can point to. And I think that's a big part of how Bitcoin propagated the way that it did. I do think it becomes interesting as regulators start to take interest in that. And it's something that the Financial Action Task Force has said that they're watching closely. I think that it's hard that the technology itself is instantaneous and global, but regulation is very slow to change and very different locally. So even between Canada and the US, we're more the same than we are different, but we're quite different in terms of our legislative frameworks. And so understanding that can be incredibly challenging. I think for a lot of companies, when they're starting out, they look at it and say, we want to serve the world. And there's beautiful intention in that. But when it's something that has regulatory capture that's covered by laws and regulations, there's not a global set of regulations that you can abide by that's going to get you everything that you need. You have to care about where you're located. You have to care about where your client is located. Some of that paradigm shifts when we start to have organizations that don't have a geographic center. And I think that I don't know what that's going to look like. I think that we need different paradigms to deal with that. I think that we need different tools to deal with that. And we're seeing some of those things emerge. I do think that from that perspective, again, for folks that are working on those projects, it's incredibly important to think about those legal contexts and how those tools are actually being used, and to look at the prevention of those tools being used for malfeasance, especially if you're maintaining the code base. And I think that's something that we've seen in a number of recent cases where there's this idea that, oh, but was this decentralized, or was this really a person who ought to have known better and who is maintaining things and who is designing in such a way where they were aware that it was actually being used for malfeasance and then did nothing to prevent that. And I think where that's the case, you're going to see regulators and law enforcement that are pretty motivated to have those facilities shut down. I think it's important for companies to be aware of that if you have funders and you have a company and it has a website and it has an address, you can't just say we've sprinkled the dust of decentralization on something and called it DeFi, and so we're immune to regulation. No one is buying that. not law enforcement, not your regulators. And they are your regulators if you're in their jurisdiction or serving customers in their jurisdiction. And so I think that we're going to see essentially continued enforcement actions in that space and companies continuing to be reined in that regard and either have to develop in a way that's compliant or leave those jurisdictions. If your compliance strategy has been based on looking at a much bigger company and saying, okay, they're doing X, they obviously have more money to pay folks than we do, and they're doing this, so it must be compliant and it must be perfect. And you then see that company get themselves offside with a regulator and you see the big public announcements and you see the big public fines, go fix your stuff. They got it wrong. You based yourself on what they were doing. That means you're also getting it wrong. Fix it. It's always better to find it internally, to fix it, even if you have to go hat in hand and do a bit of a mea culpa with your regulator to say, we've made an error. A lot of regulators actually have a process for that where you can voluntarily self-disclose non-compliance, and it's actually seen in a much more positive light, particularly when it's substantial, than it is to just not, we knew about it, we didn't fix it, we didn't find it, where really we ought to have known that was the case. If you're looking at one of these big penalties that have happened recently and saying, oh, we're in the same boat, fix it. The best time to fix it was yesterday, but the second best time is today.
Thank you so much, Amber. I cannot thank you enough for sharing your story. I'm certain that people are going to be inspired by this, and I can't wait to do this again.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Bitcoin doesn't just make us reconsider what money is and how it works. It's also making us reconsider how we need to regulate money in a digital age. When we invented faster cars, we increased the speed limit and demanded people wear seatbelts so that we could all move faster safely. When digital signatures became easier and faster to verify than physical ones, we changed the legal definition of a signature to allow for faster transactions. Much of a regulatory framework in finance today was drafted before the advent of the computer, let alone the internet or the iPhone. Now, allowing money to move faster and with less friction can allow bad actors to dress up as good ones and hurt people. An example of this is what happened to Celsius clients back in 2021. Celsius was a crypto lending platform that went bankrupt because of bad practices. We at Ledin were part of the cleanup process by being the lender that allowed borrowers to refinance their loans out of bankruptcy. To think that governments will not try to protect consumers from this is naive. This is why it's imperative that we as an industry are open with and work closely with governments and regulators to build the frameworks that we think are needed for our industry to flourish. I want to thank Amber once again for joining us, sharing your story and your insights, and I have linked her website and all of their social links into the show notes for you. Thank you all once again, and see you soon with another great episode. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledin.io. That's ledin.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.